Iran announces the arrest of over 24 Takfiri terrorists in connection with the recent deadly terror attack on a holy shrine in the city of Shiraz. The Yemeni Ansarullah movement reacts to the visit of an American military delegation to Yemen, warning of US attempts to create tensions in the country. Also ahead, world leaders are gathering in Egypt for the UN climate summit COP27 amid calls for the rich countries to provide funding to other nations vulnerable to climate change. Hello and welcome to this hour's world news at our headquarters in Tehran. Many thanks for joining us. Iran's intelligence ministry says it has so far arrested 26 Takfiri terrorists in connection with the recent terror attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The ministry says the detainees are nationals of the Azerbaijan Republic, Tajikistan and Afghanistan. The ministry says the terrorist who coordinated the terror attack is a national of the Azerbaijan Republic. According to the ministry, some of the detainees were plotting to carry out acts of terror in various cities, including in the southeastern city of Zahedan. The ministry vowed its operation will continue until all people behind the incident in Shiraz are identified and punished. It saw a gunman enter Shah Cheragh Shrine and open fire on pilgrims, killing over a dozen and injuring another 21. Daesh terror group has claimed responsibility. Iran's defense ministry has unveiled the upgraded Bavar 373 long-range missile system and launched Sayyad B4 missile production line. Salman Khojouri reports.
Iran has unveiled the Bavar 373 missile system with a range of over 300 kilometers. Moreover, the Sayyad B4 defense missile production line was also inaugurated on Sunday in a ceremony attended by Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at the range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at the range of more than 300 kilometers.
Bavar 373 missile system has successfully hit targets at a range of 305 kilometers. This missile system has been designed to counter long-range targets, ballistic missiles, warplanes and bombers. Even many technologically advanced countries aspire to have such a high-tech missile system.
The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers.
The missile system has been totally produced and upgraded by Iranian specialists at the Defense Ministry and the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have been able to upgrade the range of this missile in only 2 years. This shows that we can counter all kinds of threats by using domestically made defensive equipment. As much as the threats advance, the Bavar 373 system and other air defense systems advance ahead of their current threats.
The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement height has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers. In the past couple of years, Iran has reached self-sufficiency in manufacturing different types of missiles to boost its defensive capabilities with the aim of protecting its territorial integrity and national sovereignty. Salman Khojouri, Tehran.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement warns that the US and UK are preparing for a fresh round of escalation in the Arab country. A senior Ansarullah official says several Western military delegations, including from the US, have visited Yemen over the past week. Ali Al-Qahoum made the comments in an interview with Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen news network. Meanwhile, according to Yemeni media, the U.S. delegations are focused on the Hadramaut province to access its oil. Ansarullah accuses Saudi Arabia, the UAE and their allies of plundering Yemen's oil and other natural resources. Recently, it launched a drone attack on a southern oil port. It said the attack was meant to deter attempts to steal Yemen's crude. Political activist and commentator Hossein al-Bukhaiti says the U.S. wants Saudi dominion over Yemen.
As the United States is stealing the oil from Syria for many years, they are actually doing exactly the same in Yemen. They wanted to fund the war on Yemen using Yemeni oil, despite the fact that Yemenis have not got their salaries in the public sector for about 5 years, because United States, with the support of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, has actually moved the central bank from Sana'a to Aden, and they want actually to have more pressure on Yemeni people. They want to force Yemeni civilians and Yemeni army to surrender to Saudi Arabia and Saudi and United Arab Emirates occupation. But as the Yemeni army has warned 2 weeks ago that if the Saudi Arabia were not totally lift the blockade, allow Yemeni to use their oil to pay salaries either in areas under the control of Sana'a or areas under the occupation of United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, that they will see more attack against Saudi Arabia.
U.S. forces have been accused of stealing tens of tankers filled with Syrian oil from the country's northeast. Local sources in Yoruba countryside say a convoy of more than 40 tankers loaded with crude from wells occupied by American forces in Hasakeh province left Syria through Mahmoudia crossing. They say the convoy entered neighboring Iraq later on. The development comes as the United States maintains its illegal presence in Syria despite objection from Damascus. Syria says the presence of U.S. forces there is aimed at tightening their grip on Syrian oil wells and looting the country's resources. World leaders are expected to meet in Egypt for COP27 climate talks with emissions cuts and funding to fight global warming high on the agenda. Some 110 heads of states and governments are expected to participate in 2 days of UN talks in Sharm el-Sheikh. At the opening ceremony on Sunday, delegates agreed to discuss provision of funding to developing countries to fight the climate crisis caused by rich nations. Participating countries were also urged to adhere to their climate change obligations despite the financial crises they may be facing. The COP27 summit comes amid criticism that progress on curbing emissions has not been enough since the previous event in Scotland. We were joined earlier by historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling. Here is his take on the COP27 climate summit in Egypt.
Lots of money is going into this. If just a fraction of that was going to the United Nations, for example, which only meets for 5 days a year, I think we'd see a UN which was much more capable. So this almost seems to be one of the places where the world leaders come together, which is eclipsing the United Nations, rather like the World Economic Forum, because its budget is so much bigger. So there are 2 weeks there. We can plan to lessen pollution, but we shouldn't be trying to come up with a market solution. This market solution is simply a playing games, a kind of casino way of doing it. We just have to say, no, we have to do less of this. So there's also some controversy about to what extent climate change is being man-made, what extent the sun and other things have an effect on it. I think, you know, for me, I'm pretty clear that man does have quite a big effect on the climate. But there are a lot of scientists that contend with this, and the mass media, certainly in Britain, shuts them out of the discussion, shuts them out of the debate. And for example, back in 2013, we heard the scientists themselves at the IPCC, the UN body that's responsible for all this, saying that the average temperature hasn't risen for the last 15 years, and we're going to have to massage our report in order to try and make out that it has.
Welcome to the news review section of our program. Anger is simmering over Italy's refusal to let in migrants plucked from the sea. A German rescue charity organization says it will take legal action against the Italian government for violating international law. The organization says it will file petition in courts in two Italian cities of Rome and Catania. That after Italy barred around 200 migrants to get off a rescue ship in Catania. Prior to that, Italian authorities let in 144 vulnerable passengers on board a German-flagged vessel while refusing to accept others. Those allowed to disembark were children and the sick. The ship was then ordered to leave the port city of Catania. Italy is now facing criticism for its selective approach towards receiving migrants. Human rights groups have called on Rome to stop discrimination. They say the law of the sea requires that all rescued migrants should be disembarked in a safe place. Joining us for this news review discussion is Max Civili and Peter Koenig, geopolitical analyst from Geneva. Gentlemen, thanks to the both of you for joining us. I really appreciate it. Max, I'll start with you. Please give us an update on the situation of the migrants in the Gulf of Catania.
Well, the standoff between the government and charity ships trying to disembark refugees in the port continues. A decision on the issues, as you mentioned before, will be taken by administrative courts as the charity ship Humanity will appeal against a decree issued by the Italian government which allows only women, children and ill people to disembark. So far, 315 asylum seekers of 572 have managed to leave the rescue boat Geo Barents. Frankly, I don't understand why everybody's so surprised about what's happening in the port of Catania and about the attitude of Italy's far-right government, which is simply the flip side of the coin of EU's tough, inhuman migration policies. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni had said in several occasions, even during the electoral campaign, she made clear that she wants to reverse Italy's already shrunken humanitarianism on refugees. She clearly said she wants to set up a naval blockade to prevent asylum seekers fleeing Libya. So the fact that Giorgia Meloni has issued a decree which allows only women and children and ill people to disembark should not really come as a surprise. Having said that, we should also look at EU's responsibilities and Italy's previous center-left government's responsibilities. They set up an horrific system through an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government that basically keep the refugees stuck in Libyan horrific detention centers.
Absolutely. Peter, over to you. We have been aware of the structural flaws within EU's migration policies. Can we say it has been exacerbated with the rise of right-wing politics within EU governments, in this case Italy and its new right-wing administration?
Yes and no. Thank you first for having me. But yes and no. This is a very complex situation, this refugees. The European Union, I think we have to really take a few steps back and look at what's behind it and has been behind it for many years. The European Union, on the one hand, they say, well, it's a human rights abuse if a country doesn't accept refugees from North Africa and from Asia, from poor countries. Well, yes, but on the other hand, we have to see also who is behind the organization of these refugees. Many of those organizations are NGOs, and most of them are European NGOs. As was mentioned, the ship that unloaded some of the refugees was a German-flagged ship. So, you know, it's not even refugees, NGOs from the countries of where the refugees come. And there's a lot of money behind of all of this. This is one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that the European Union is hell-bent to destroy itself. And this sounds like an oxymoron, but refugees is a dividing factor because the World Economic Forum and the United States, they cannot use for the One World Order a group of people, you know, a community of 27 countries whose GDP is higher than the one of the United States. So there, anything to divide this block is good. And one of the big dividers are the refugees. Now, the right-wing government of Giorgia Meloni, she has said from the beginning, and your correspondent in Rome acknowledged that too, that Italy will accept people who have health issues and pregnant women, but not necessarily all the others. And I think Greece is about in the same league, and Portugal too, and maybe soon Spain, because they're all unloaded on these southern countries. They weaken them more because handling refugees has a high cost. And the northern European countries, they do not contribute to that, or at least not enough. So it's all on the shoulders of Italy, Greece, Portugal, Spain, and with very, very little contribution from northern countries. And the issue behind it is, again, you know, these countries, and especially those that are right-wing, considered right-wing countries, in the case of Italy, it's clear. I mean, there's no dispute that Giorgia Meloni belongs to the, excuse me, to a very right-wing party. But the right wings, and this is what irks the European Union, the people in Brussels, and those who are globalists, and the World Economic Forum and Washington, is they are not globalists. Mm-hmm. These right-wing governments, they are nationalists, and they do not want to have anything to do with globalism, which is trying to take over the world. And so anything that counts, I know I'm not talking very much about the refugees right now, but the refugees are an instrument in this destabilizing these countries. So I think we have to look at it from different aspects. Look, for example, the other controversy is they apply double standards. The Ukrainians, some of them are very rich people, not all, of course, very many are poor, but the refugees from Ukraine, they are let into these countries, they are welcome, they get anything they need and that they want.
Absolutely. Thank you so much to the both of you gentlemen for joining us. Peter Koenig from Geneva, geopolitical analyst, and Max Civili from Rome. Thanks to the both of you. And on that note, we've come to the end of our news review programme. In the UK, public discontent with the government is lingering. Thousands from across the country descended upon the capital, London, on the weekend to protest the country's worsening cost of living crisis and to demand a general election. Said Purraza has been to the protest and sent us this report.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction. It's led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises. The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad, such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come. The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increased interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saeed Pariza, London.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. If it was enough to know what was true on a theoretical level and to have belief in one's heart, then Amr bin As should be the first Shia in the world. The same Amr bin As even composed verses of poetry in praise of Ali. Amr bin As, who, on his deathbed, at that sensitive moment of a person's life, expressed regret and showed remorse, who said that he had sold his religion for the worldly promises of Muawiyah and fought Ali, even though he knew Ali was right. So, from where I'm sitting, Amr's faith was deeper and more insightful than the Shia of the 14th century, who find out about the imamate of the commander of the faithful and believe in it. Is Amr one of the Shia? You say he's not. Why isn't he then? Because you and I both know that when you believe in the imamate of the commander of the faithful alayhi salam, there are certain duties that become incumbent upon you. Your first duty is to not pledge allegiance with Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan. But Amr joined forces with Muawiyah and fought Imam Ali. In other words, because he did not observe the moral duties and responsibilities that this belief directs towards a person, that is why he isn't a Shia. This principle is correct, and because it is correct, I want to apply it to us.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
On the same basis, let us ask, am I sure I am a Shia? Are you sure you are a Shia? Do we do our duties as Shias? Do we uphold our moral responsibilities? The Quran speaks clearly and unambiguously about this. It explicitly negates faith from anyone who categorically neglects the moral duties that faith engenders. Therefore, the faith that Islam values and recognizes, this is one of the fundamental principles of Islam and Shiism, is the faith that gives rise to moral duties and sustains these. It is the faith that is always accompanied by moral responsibility, and if it is not, then it is not expected to have its desired effect. So do not expect any assistance in this world. Do not expect any security in this world. Those who have faith and do not taint their faith with wrongdoing, for such there shall be safety, and they are the guided. The Quran, Surah 8, verse 82.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan held high-level talks in Tehran following a trilateral meeting with Russian and Azerbaijani leaders on the conflict in the Caucasus region. He was officially received by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi on Tuesday morning, and the two held talks at the Sarabat Palace in the capital, Tehran. In addition to a bilateral meeting, the two top executive officials held a meeting of high-level delegations, and after attending the signing ceremony of a cooperation document in the field of energy, they elaborated on the results of their consultations in a joint press conference. The Iranian president stated that Pashinyan's visit to Iran will be a turning point in the development of ties between the two neighboring countries.
Neighborhood policy is one of the policies emphasized by the government, and during this administration we had several meetings with Mr. Pashinyan. In these meetings, especially in this particular meeting, the focus of the negotiations was the development of commercial, economic and security relations between the two countries.
Expressing satisfaction with the growing trends of relations between the two countries, Raisi pointed to the diverse and numerous capacities available in Iran and Armenia, calling for an all-out effort to improve the level of relations and expand bilateral cooperation. The Iranian president pointed to energy cooperation as one of the capacities available to improve the level of relations between the two countries, saying, "The Islamic Republic is ready to expand cooperation in other economic and commercial areas, including in increasing the export of technical and engineering services." Also noting that the Caucasus region is a part of Iran's history, civilization, and culture, Raisi underscored that security and peace in the Caucasus region are very important for Iran. The Iranian president added that negotiations with Pashinyan led to the conclusion that resolving the issues of the region must occur at the hands of officials and authorities of the region, and any interference by foreigners will only create problems rather than solve them. Pashinyan, for his part, appreciated the constructive role of the Islamic Republic in the region and stressed that Iran's efforts have always been aimed at stabilizing and strengthening peace and security in the region. Pashinyan expressed gratitude for the priority given by Raisi's administration to the development of ties with the neighboring countries. The Armenian premier also called for strengthening transit cooperation between the two countries to connect the Black Sea to the Persian Gulf. Iran opened a consulate in the southern Armenian city of Kapan on October 21st, nearly a year after expressing interest in doing so.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian officially inaugurated the consulate. At the opening ceremony, Amir Abdollahian stated that the security of Armenia and the region is Iran's security. He called for the development of north-south transportation corridor through Armenia. He also said Tehran's policies to respect territorial integrity as well as internationally recognized borders. Tehran had previously stated that changes in its borders and transit links with Armenia would be a red line that it would not tolerate being crossed. That's when Turkey and Azerbaijan have been planning to establish a new transport link called the Zangzor Corridor. In case of opening, it will affect Iran-Armenia commerce and could sever a major Iranian transit link with the South Caucasus. Meanwhile, Tehran has not contented itself with only diplomatic messages. The inauguration of the Kapan Consulate came after several days of large-scale military exercises by IRGC near Iran's borders with Azerbaijan. The latest simultaneous diplomatic and defensive moves clearly show the Iranian government is ready to defend its national interests in all seriousness.
The United States is under fire for its efforts to influence cyberspace in the country. That's according to a controversial report by The Intercept, which is based on leaked internal memos, emails and documents of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The work is primarily done by Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is a DHS sub-agency tasked with protecting critical national infrastructure. The report says the U.S. government has pressured social media platforms to, quote, shape online discourse. The platforms include Twitter and Facebook. The department has justified this pressure on social media platforms by claiming that it wants to fight, quote, disinformation. The plan stemmed from concerns around alleged Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. It also began to take shape during the 2020 election and over efforts to shape discussions around vaccine policy during the coronavirus pandemic. But how this information is defined by the government has not been clearly articulated. There are now concerns that the inherently subjective nature of what could be classified as disinformation will give officials in the Department of Homeland Security a broad opening to make politically motivated determinations about what constitutes dangerous speech. This is while critics say the extent to which the DHS initiatives affect Americans' daily social feeds is unclear.
We must rethink our approach to cybersecurity. Releasing alerts, deploying incident response teams, sharing best practices are important tools. But as the pace and scale of cyber threats that we face expands, so must our response toolkit. We need sustained investment to modernize and protect our most critical federal systems, as well as state and local governments, suffering under budget constraints and increasingly aggressive ransomware operators.
The CISA's domain has gradually expanded to encompass more subjects it believes amount to critical infrastructure. Some believe CISA's goal is to make platforms more responsive to their demands. There are suggestions circulating inside the agency calling for an expansive role for the agency in, quote, shaping the information ecosystem. There are also calls within the agency to closely monitor social media platforms of all sizes, mainstream media, cable news, hyperpartisan media, talk radio, and other online resources. Critics say there is growing evidence that the legislative and executive branch officials are using social media companies to engage in censorship by surrogate. But the growing authoritarian acts by the DHS and the FBI to monitor Americans have raised alarm among civil rights activists. They say the authoritarian nature of such acts are contrary to the U.S. Privacy Act of 1974, which was legislated after the Watergate scandal that led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. The act prohibits state data collection of Americans exercising their First Amendment rights. Critics also say there are no specific legal constraints on the FBI's use of social media. Recently, Snowden sounded the alarm again, warning that the U.S. was expanding its mass espionage activities both inside the U.S. and outside the country.
Iran is remembering a historic day which has come to define its modern history. The day which has been named the Day of Fighting Imperialism falls on the 13th of Aban in the Persian calendar. It is symbolic for Iranians for a number of reasons. First, it represents the day when the founder of Iran's Islamic Republic was forced into exile years before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. On November 4, 1964, Imam Khomeini was forced to leave Iran for Turkey after he lashed at the Pahlavi regime for giving legal immunity to the U.S. forces in Iran. Before the Islamic Revolution, thousands of U.S. soldiers and military consultants were stationed in Iran because the country was seen by the U.S. as a major bulwark against what Americans described as the threat posed by the Soviet Union. The Pahlavi regime was totally dependent on the U.S. for its security needs, and it allowed its military and security apparatus to be taken over by U.S. agents. The capitulation law was criticized as a humiliation for Iranians, and Ayatollah Khomeini was among its fiercest critics. His exile was, and still is, seen by many Iranians as the capitulation of the Shah's regime before the Americans. Ayatollah Khomeini's exile stoked anti-U.S. sentiments among Iranians. The 13th of Aban is also significant for Iranians from another perspective. Shortly after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iranian students took over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran for its meddling in the affairs of Iran. The main reason behind the students' act was a fear from another U.S. plot against the revolution, which toppled the U.S. puppet regime in Tehran. Over the years, the U.S. has claimed that the thorny relations between Washington and Tehran is because of the U.S. embassy takeover by Iranian students. However, this is a distorted version of history presented by the U.S. establishment. His recent remarks to Iranian students, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, dismissed the U.S. assertion as a lie. Ayatollah Khamenei said that the starting point of the row goes back to the CIA-orchestrated coup of 1953. Ayatollah Khamenei was referring to the coup against the government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who had nationalized Iran's oil industry. The coup, which was followed by the temporary rule of CIA and MI6-approved General Fazlullah Zahedi, enabled the monarch, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's return from exile in Italy. It also consolidated the monarch's rule for the following 26 years, until the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, led by Imam Khomeini, which toppled the Pahlavi regime.
It was a long wait that ended in a cry of joy. Former president and left-wing candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva won the second round of the Brazilian presidential election against the incumbent far-right leader Jair Bolsonaro. With 50.9% of the vote, the leader of the Workers' Party obtained a narrow victory over his opponent, who received 49.1% of the vote. The election was Brazil's most polarizing poll since its return to democracy in 1985 after a military dictatorship. It also marked the first time that the sitting president failed to win re-election. Just over 2 million votes separated the two candidates. Addressing his supporters in a speech following the announcement of his victory, the newly elected president promised to unite a divided country. The veteran leftist leader said his win is a victory for a democratic movement above the interests of parties and ideologies.
This is not my victory, nor of the Workers' Party, nor of the parties that supported me in the campaign. It is a victory of the immense democratic movement that was created beyond the political parties, individual interests and ideologies for democracy to win.
Lula made a stunning comeback while the public credited him with building an extensive social welfare program during his previous tenure in office, helping lift millions into the middle class and being in charge of a booming economy. During the election campaigns, Bolsonaro tried to shift the debate to Lula's corruption convictions in 2018, which were later overturned by the country's top court. However, he failed. Bolsonaro's popularity never exceeded 40% during his 4 years in office. He faced wide criticism over a slew of issues, including his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, inflation, and high fuel prices. He has been widely criticized by public health experts for his failure to respond to the pandemic in a timely fashion and reluctance to introduce restrictive measures in fear of damaging the economy.
Just 4 out of 10 households have access to food of adequate quality and quantity. The majority, 58.7%, live with some level of food insecurity. This is equivalent to around 125 million people. Also, large-scale deforestation of the Amazon accelerated under Bolsonaro, reaching a 15-year high in 2021. In his third term, Lula has inherited a sluggish economy, tighter budget constraints, and a more hostile legislature from the country's most right-wing government in decades. Lula has vowed a return to state-driven economic growth and social policies that helped lift millions out of poverty when he governed Brazil from 2003 to 2010. Soon after the announcement of Lula's victory in the tight runoff presidential vote, congratulations poured in. Among the list of world leaders who rushed to express their joy about Lula's victory was a long list of regional leftist leaders, including Argentina's Alberto Fernandez and Mexico's Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Lula's win is the latest example of Latin American countries choosing to dethrone incumbent parties on the right and center-right of the political spectrum. From Mexico in the north to Chile in the south, the region's political map suggests Latin America is set to see a new wave of pink tide of leftist governments that swept into power in the 1990s. The return of leftist governments in the region would bring closer cooperation across Latin America and is a clear indication of region-wide rejection of U.S. policies. Experts believe that the emergence of leftist politicians in Latin America will expand China's circle of friends in the region based on the fact that Latin America will attach more importance to political and economic cooperation with Beijing. Washington has for years backed the wrong players in the region, many educated or trained in the U.S., but Americans have turned a blind eye to the civil society's demands for change in the region, which has meant the departure of the U.S. favorite actors.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
spring of truth. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. We all honor that Baqir ul-Ulum, the fifth infallible Imam, who is the highest personality of history in the domain of divine knowledge, belongs to us. His station is known only by Almighty Allah, the Holy Prophet, and infallible Imams. We are honored that we follow the Ja'fari school of thought, and that our jurisprudence, or fiqh, which is the infinite ocean of knowledge, is from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, peace be upon him.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the prayers and supplications. In one of his speeches, he mentioned that prayers take men out of darkness, and once out of darkness, they become men who work for God, take up sword in the path of God, kill and get killed for the sake of God, and his uprising is also for God. Prayers do not deactivate men. Now, this part of speech was given at the time when they were involved in the 8 years war, which was between the Iran and Iraq. And there he was explaining the people, the soldiers, those who raised to save their country, that there are some people who make excuses that they cannot go in order to protect their country. They cannot raise for the sake of God. Why? Because if they want to get nearness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or God, they have to take the path of prayers, supplications, or they have to spend their life in this path, which is a kind of, you can say, like just getting busy into prayer and all those things. Imam Khomeini has said that it's the other way, that the person who is more close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the one who prays on time, the one who spends his time in supplications, whenever there is a time in order to save Islam, whenever there is a time to save your country, this person is the first person who raises for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Why? Because he is near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He knows what Allah or God wants him. The very first priority for every person is to save his country. If someone is coming and invading their country, they must protect their home because the country is the home. And if someone is attacking me, if someone wants to invade my home, I should not allow them to take over my home, to invade my country, to take my home. Why? Because my household is living there. My family is there. Everything is my home. Therefore, Imam Khomeini also said that the prayers, the supplications, it takes us towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and it takes us out of darkness. It takes us to the light where we understand the importance of home. Because if we have a home, we can easily practice our religion. If we do not have home the way we should, we cannot pray easily. We cannot have the purification the way we want. Therefore, it is necessary to be with God, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never.
everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the simmering political crisis in Pakistan, with former Premier Imran Khan announcing his anti-government and anti-army campaign. And we shall also look at how the construction of hydropower dams in Indian-administered Kashmir has put the environment and local communities at risk.
Pakistan continues to lurch from one crisis to another. Former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who was unceremoniously ousted earlier this year, has stepped up his fight against his political rivals and the powerful army. The power struggle in a country grappling with a grave economic crisis may alter the political paradigm, especially with Pakistan's top election body disqualifying the former premier from holding office for 5 years. Whether he will prevail in this battle or meet the fate of his predecessors remains to be seen.
Since April, when cricketer-turned-politician and former Premier Imran Khan was removed from office through a parliamentary no-confidence vote, the political environment in Pakistan has been highly charged. Khan has accused the Pakistan Muslim League government, led by Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, of conspiring with the country's powerful army and the United States to oust him. There have been massive political rallies across Pakistan in recent months organized by his supporters, while the PML government has launched a serious crackdown on Khan and his party leaders. Last month, Pakistan's top election body disqualified Khan from holding a public office for 5 years, accusing him of selling gifts he received from foreign dignitaries as prime minister. The populist leader termed the decision a politically motivated move to sideline him. The ruling could render him ineligible to run in Pakistan's next general elections. Amidst these developments, a prominent Pakistani journalist considered close to Khan was killed in mysterious circumstances in Kenya. He had fallen out with the country's military after Khan was removed from office, which has prompted many to link his murder to the military. All eyes are now on the so-called Long March Imran Khan has launched to demand early elections when it reaches the capital, Islamabad.
In the short order which we have received till now, the Imran Khan has been disqualified for the time being. Now it is up to him to file appeal before the Honorable Supreme Court, and the main decision will again come from the Supreme Court that for which term he is disqualified. So it will be seen at later on stage.
The looming uncertainty over Imran Khan's political fate and the much anticipated change of guard in the military next month has put the South Asian country on the edge. Political instability is accompanied by worsening social and economic outlook. Pakistan's economy continues to be under stress amid downgraded ratings, devalued bonds, depleting foreign reserves, and millions of people in need of assistance following the recent devastating floods. Combined with political volatility, the country appears to be struggling to stay afloat.
The latest political upheaval in Pakistan comes amid a deeply volatile and polarized political atmosphere. This is the country where no elected prime minister has managed to complete a full term in office. Imran Khan says the only way to halt his anti-government campaign is to hold early elections.
The Election Commission is a biased organization, as we all know. They are manipulating all these affairs. They are doing it in a way that actually created chaos in Pakistan politics. So I believe that this decision will create only a chaos in Pakistan politics, not more than that.
Last week, in the first press conference ever by the country's intelligence chief, Nadeem Anjum accused Khan of seeking to foment anarchy in the country. He responded to sharp attacks on the military by Khan in recent weeks, including references to Army Chief General Kamar Bajwa as traitor. Bajwa is set to step down next month with all eyes on his yet-to-be-appointed successor.
The disqualification is actually under Article 63.1b. It's for the time being disqualified. He is disqualified from the National Assembly. He is disqualified for the Provincial Assembly. He cannot be elected at this time because he is disqualified under this decision of the Election Commission.
The political crisis in Pakistan is combined with a fledgling economy amid warnings from rating agencies that it must take hard decisions to avoid economic default. Global rating agency Fitch recently cut the country's sovereign credit rating from B to CCC+, citing a drop in its liquidity and foreign reserves. Noted economist Steve Hank says the government has failed to save the sinking ship. This is while the country is still trying to recover from the devastating floods that wreaked havoc across the country recently, displacing millions of people.
Now to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Malik Ayub Sumbal, a political analyst from Islamabad. Mr. Sumbal, welcome to the program. Now, Pakistan is grappling today with both political and an economic crisis as former Premier Imran Khan fights for his survival amid crackdown from the government and also the military. So the question is, where is the country headed?
I think, unfortunately, Pakistan is in the very bad days. If we recall our memories and if we can go back in 1971, I think that the same time, the same political deadlock witnessed at that time in which we have lost East Pakistan. So unfortunately, again, we are at the same crossroad. And ultimately here, unfortunately, I would say that it's not the public interest, but it's the interest of the politician, their vested interest, and whatever they want that everybody wants into power. So this is actually the tragedy and the dilemma right now. That's keep Pakistan politician at a very crossroad under the current circumstances, if we see.
So do you think Imran Khan's demand for early elections will be accepted with the Shahbaz or by the Shahbaz Sharif government? And what are his party's chances in the next general elections?
So to accept the demand of the early election is not only on the will or on the decision of the Shahbaz Sharif, because he is actually the nominated and the elected prime minister of the PDM, Pakistan Democratic Movement, which is the major alliance of all the political parties. So it's not on the discretion or the decision of the Shahbaz Sharif, but to all the other stakeholders who are involved in this PDM, who are the part of the government right now. So will his demands will be accepted? So I think that will tell us his protest, that how much people he can take out during his power show that he's going to be, because it's going to be something like very decisive moment, that if Imran Khan will not bring such a mass population, which he is claiming through his various processions and demonstration, so then that will be a very downfall for all his recent boom that we've seen in the recent weeks, in which I can say that one of the tactics to blackmail the military establishment and the current government. So it's not on the it's not only the decision of the prime minister, but the other stakeholders who are currently the part of the government.
So in Pakistan, the military has always had the final word, and no political leader has managed to challenge the military authority. Now, do you think Khan will buck the trend or meet the fate of his predecessors?
I don't think so that Imran Khan has challenged the military, actually, in reality, because this is actually the military for which he has been taken into the power. This is the military, and now he has only the demand of like a stubborn child who is demanding that